Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. This is officially our fourth anniversary show. I think we kicked off on June the 9th, 2011. And here we are, apparently, in 2015, still rocking it out. I'm not sure I would have believed you if I told you that's what would have happened, but that's what it was. And today's been one of those not-so-easy radio days. I kicked off the day finding out that the guests we've actually had booked for a while were unfortunately not able to make it. We'll reserve them for a later date, I'm sure. And that's the way. If everybody's volunteering, you can't really insist on contractual obligations and all that sort of stuff. So we were going to be talking about ethical beekeeping and some of the extraordinary healing methods that are used in the Amazonian rainforest, some of which I think are probably applicable here. Like I say, that show will probably come down the line 2 or 3 weeks or so. We had a bit of technical problem as well with the operating system and the broadcaster and all of that, and it all adds to the excitement of the piece, it has to be said. As it is though, I nipped out at sort of 6:30, 7 o'clock tonight and recorded an alternative interview with some local folk here in Mid Wales that I only met yesterday. I'd actually heard of them before, and out there running very interesting community program just outside the local town that we spend some time hanging around about, as it were. And it seems to me that they're really, really getting results. They're running kind of like a forest school, but doing quite a lot of other work as well. And they're doing it in what was a community site a long time ago. Synchro, I think, has mentioned it before. It's called Ashfield. And in times gone by, it was a small holding that was being run with funding to help out all sorts of people with differently enabled folk, really. In those days, they were called mentally handicapped and physically handicapped. And I'm sure there's different words for those things nowadays. And the idea was that people would come there to learn about and get their hands dirty with a bit of horticulture. And they did things like growing lots of plants, growing lots of veg. They also did stuff around the town, making hanging baskets and all that kind of stuff. And by all accounts, the place was incredibly successful in as far as some of the people that came there as what would nowadays be called clients ended up coming back as volunteers. So people who beforehand had maybe been finding it a little bit difficult to get by in the world actually found a place where they could not only survive, but where they could thrive and where they could help other people and where they could do what a lot of people want to do, which is garden and be outside. The place, I think, has been under new management, as it were, for some time now. And I think it's kind of careered a little bit from one thing to another. But to tonight's recorded guests, Matt and Tiff, have been given a couple of acres there to set about all of their various projects. And one of the things that struck me about them was their sheer enthusiasm. But as it turns out, they've also got quite a lot of knowledge and experience between them. And it seems to me that they're doing actually a remarkable job of one of the things that the Dr. Rock radio show really likes to foster, which is community and communication. Round here in Mid Wales, it can be a little bit difficult for people to get about because everything's a bit of a long way from everywhere else. There's a lot of diesel involved in moving. There's not a lot of public transport. And it can also be somewhat difficult to get the word out. It seems, though, that as well as local advertising, social media has helping them a bit. And I think people genuinely have an enthusiasm for what it is they're doing. So the interview this evening, I think it's just over an hour long. It's about what they're doing out there and what they've been doing, really not for very long. And there's probably going to be a bit of background noise because it was because I only finished recording it at 8:10 this evening and then had to come scuttling back and set everything up. I haven't had a chance to listen to all of it, but hopefully you'll be able to hear it and I will come back to you afterwards. The opening tracks for tonight's show, the last one you heard there was called You Make Your Own Life Hard, which seems to me to be a fair message given what we know. It's by a band called the Buffalo Skinners, who I saw, danced to, and very much enjoyed at this year's Fire in the Mountain Festival, of which a little bit more later. Before that was another track off Gold Ray's new EP, the band from that I met in Glastonbury. The track's called Calling Your Name, another quite applicable track, I think. And a bit of psychedelic rock, it really takes this old geezer back hearing music like that in 2015. And I really look forward to hearing what they're going to do next. There's another couple of tracks on that EP, which probably over the next few weeks you'll get to hear as well. And before that, Zig Zig Sputnik and 21st Century Boy. So without more ado, I shall play the chat I had with Matt and Tiff. And as you can hear, I'm pretty enthusiastic about what they're doing. I think we'll probably be hearing from them again. And hopefully both Synchro and I will be involving ourselves in some of the projects they've got running there. So here we go.
Thank you very much, Matt and Tiff, for standing in for my missing guests on tonight's Dr. Rock's radio show. I really do appreciate it, and very, very big welcome to peoplesinternetradio.com. And it's lovely to be here in your field with all of these trees and a fire in the background and all of that. How did you come to doing this, the outside life then, Matt? What was your path to here?
Oh, blimey, it started a while ago. Well, I did a degree in wildlife and countryside conservation. And I went and did the summer camps in America, and they just saw my degree and said you should work with kids outdoors, and I've never thought about it before. And that was it. Spent 2 years in America doing the summer camps, outdoor education, wonderful place in Rhode Island. And it was fantastic. We did all sorts of things, like night camp, where they'd stay, you know, they'd stay up till 12 o'clock one night, then two nights to stay up the entire night and sleep through the day. And there are trips we take them to the zoo, all sorts of amazing things.
How many children did you have on those?
We had a group of about 15 to 20 each. So you'd have a leader and then a camp counsellor of like 16, 17 years old. It was just wonderful, and it was unique, you know.
Yeah, and how long did the camps last? How long were they there?
5 days, I think. Yeah, you had the same group for 5 days, so it was really nice. You got to see him progress and go through the homesickness period and then come out the other side and really not want to go home at the end of it.
Must have made a real difference to the kids.
Yeah, it certainly did. They loved it, and it's like what we do now, you know. You just see the change in the kids and the progression through forest school. They just change, you know, for the better. Yeah, you know?
How long ago was the American experience?
10 years ago, 12 years ago, something like that.
So it's taken you a while to work towards the manifestation.
Yeah, well, as I said, I mean, I did 2 years there, and then I worked in North London at a place called Cuffley Camp, which is wonderful. It's well known by the locals, and they all, you know, meet people. Oh, yeah, I went to Cuffley Camp, you know, if they lived in Hertfordshire. And that was a fantastic place. It was an ancient woodland, and we had those beautiful pollarded hornbeams with faces in the trees, and the kids would stay there overnight for anything from one night to 5 nights. And yeah, I lived in a shed there for about 4 years and travelled over the winter and did some outdoor education and everything in different countries in the winters, just volunteering and woofing and everything, which is also brilliant. And then after 4 years of that, I there's one page on a website, and it just said, come and work for us if you want, like, adventure. Why not? Gave it a go. And there's about 15 of us when we began at the Bushcraft Company. And now it's a multi-million pound company, and it's probably the largest bushcraft company on earth, pretty much, per person.
What sort of stuff does that do?
Again, the kids would stay over, residential. They'd either come for the day, or they'd stay one night, or they'd stay 4 nights, 5 days. And we'd teach them bushcraft skills, survival skills. You know, a lot of playing games and things like that as well, obviously. And it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful, and I did that for at least 6 years, I think, something like that. I can't remember.
You don't look like you've been around long enough to have all this experience.
And then there's a baby face.
Young-looking chap.
Yeah, 34 next month.
What would you say, what were the bushcraft skills that those children, or those offspring, took to?
Well, we tried to keep it progressive, so we'd go through what you need, so it'd be, you know, fire, shelter, water. We'd teach them traps. We would go through animal butcheries occasionally. There was a lot of bonding between the groups as well, because, and with teachers. Teachers would come along, and it's incredible the change you see in not just the kids but the teachers as well. And what we would do, the teachers arrive, we take care of the kids, the teachers go and sit in a lovely area, and they would sit there and drink lots of tea and coffee and chat, and you know, they loved it, they really bonded. And also the kids, you know, the shy ones would come out of the shells. Sometimes the kids who are a little bit more rambunctious in school calm down and help the shyer ones, or you know, and it was just wonderful. Everybody, every child, I think, when they've been outdoors for a certain period of time, especially residential camps, everyone becomes equal by the second to third day. Everyone is equal on the same level. There's no hierarchy anymore. It completely goes out the window.
So we might conclude from that isolation from nature is one of the things that's causing the kind of breakdown in community.
I completely understand that one. Yeah.
And you can't really beat helping somebody else for building self-esteem, can you?
Yeah, well, I mean, what we're doing at the moment, actually, which is, again, wonderful with the progression side of things, is parents might come up to us and say, you know, are there... they have trouble listening. Could you work on their listening skills? Or they tend not to mix in groups. Can you try and help them out with that sort of thing? And, you know, we start them on the path and then nature does the rest. It's like today, this is the fifth week of after school club.
Yes, I think so. Maybe sixth.
And there's a few in the group that maybe didn't start to play with each other or anything like that. They isolated themselves or they brought technology with them. And now, this fifth week, I mean, we barely did anything, did we? We started them off, we said some of the activities. They weren't, you know, they just went. Nature was the activity. We didn't need to do anything. They didn't want to do anything else, so we weren't going to push it.
Brilliant.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know.
And what was your degree like? Was it a three-year degree?
Well, it was one of those ones. I did a Bachelor of Science, and then some wonderful teacher came up to me and said, you know, if you do 2 years of foundation degree, you get marked on the, you know, exactly the same work, exactly the same lessons, but your exams are marked at a lower level sort of thing, so you don't have to get as good grades and everything, and then jump on the BSc at the end. So I started a BSc, then moved down to foundation quickly. yeah, it was wonderful. It's a lot of surveying work, and we did a lot of sort of fence building, practical conservation, that kind of thing. But I think with conservation, there's a lot of legislation these days, you know, practical conservation, there's lots of skilled people for that, but actually keeping the areas in the first place from development is probably the hardest part of conservation, I would say.
Yeah.
Again, it was a long time ago.
And what about you, Tiff? What brought you to this field of work?
Well, I started working in the outdoors when I also worked at the British Craft Company, which is where I met Matt, and so the love story began. And I then went on to work in a nursery, and really struggled with, there was a lot of time spent indoors, and when we did go outdoors, it was, you know, we didn't have an outdoor space, and it was really difficult for the children because they were either at the park or on a walk. And having worked at Bushcraft, I saw lots of really beautiful play in the outdoors, and I thought, oh, these kids really, really need that. So I went to my forest school training. They were very lovely, and they helped me fund my forest school training. And we started to do forest school with the preschool group, and we went out every week all year round. And the changes that we saw in the kids were absolutely incredible. It was amazing, you know. And so then we decided that we'd had enough of living in Oxfordshire, and we'd moved to Mid Wales. Well, Matt was living here for a while already, and I thought I'd follow on. And there weren't really any forest schools around, and I was looking. I kept looking for work and looking for forests, and I thought, you know what? Well, we'll set something up. Yeah. Let's just do it. There's obviously a need for it in the area, and let's just go for it. And here we are.
Very good. And did you feel can you feel the difference between Wales and Oxfordshire?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference.
A few less cars, you know.
So. Yeah. I love it. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful place to be. Yeah. And we made the right choice in coming here, definitely.
We felt, because we lived in Herefordshire for 6 months or so, we popped over the border and then popped back again. And we felt that you could almost feel how heavily tied up the countryside was over there, that they're practically, there's only really footpaths that you can go on. And even some of those are quite difficult to traverse. So there's plenty of open space out here. You found yourself a nice space here to to base yourself, the old Ashfield Centre.
Yes, we were very lucky. They were very enthusiastic to have us and helped facilitate it and getting us on the land and, you know, happy for us to do what we wanted to do, basically plant all the trees and, you know, we've got bees up the top and he was happy for us to be there and, you know, the kids are really interested in that and that's really nice. And, you know, we've got the lovely stream and it's just a really nice place to be. And one day it'll be a really lovely woodland. You know, all the trees take.
So how many trees have you planted and what sort of trees did you go for?
We got 400 trees from the Woodland Trust and we applied for working wood because we thought if we're going to be doing bits and bobs at forest school, you know, if we're still around when those trees are big enough to do that with. We've got oak, rowan, willow, some cherry, silver birch and field maple. So quite a nice mix. Got some pioneer species in there that shoot right up and some lovely oaks because that's nice. And there's actually quite a lot of self-seeded ash already, hence Ashfield.
Yeah. So the trees themselves, I find, are a matter of interest to the children, aren't they?
Yeah.
I know that Jess was saying that some children don't even realise to start with that there's a difference between them or that they've got names and things like that. Mm. Do you work with the trees with the children? Did they all try to plant them?
Oh yeah, we had a community day, didn't we? And a lot of the lovely local public turned up and with their little kids and they planted a lot.
Cute,
and
it was wasn't it?
All these tiny little things and it wasn't brilliant with her, you know. These tiny little things in these big old waterproof overalls and stuff running around. They couldn't have been, 2 foot high, you know?
And they come running down the hill with one tree.
Little tree.
We had 400 trees to plant. They're running down the hill
on their face.
With their little tree in their hands, wobbling around. But yeah, it was great. We had lots of the community come out and it was our first ever sort of event and we weren't expecting really any help at all. And we had a good
30, 40 people turn up.
Yeah, and it was great. And they all got stuck in and they all really enjoyed it.
Well, that's a really good turnout for around here because it is difficult to get people out. So what was your forest school training like? How long did that last and what sort of things did you have to do to get that?
We have to go on, I did a fast track one which meant that I could do all the practical days in a week. And because I'd done quite a lot of the practical skills at Bushcraft, I thought that would probably be the best choice for me so I could just go there and do it. And then after that, there's a lot of theory behind it, all about the ethos and the principles and everything like that. And that takes a year for everything to come through. So you work on you have a portfolio that you work on after you've done your practical. And then you also have to do your 6 weeks forest school with somewhere that will let you do it, basically, to do your 6 weeks sort of training and running it. So that you can get a real feel of it and then your assessor will come out and see how you're doing, give you any tips and, you know, help you along the way and then they give you a sort of final pass at the end or fail.
What was your favourite bit of that?
Just being out there and doing it. I just really loved it. But I did actually really enjoy all the theory behind it because there was all sorts of things that I'd always sort of felt that I'd, having worked in the nursery setting and seen lots of different things and how the children worked and how they played and how they learnt and how some of them learnt best, and then putting the theory, learning the theory and then applying it and going, actually, yeah, I was right. You know, my gut instinct was right. We did need to be doing this. And it was just a really, really nice sort of affirmation of what I'd always believed.
Yeah. And what do you think was the main difference between the sort of forest school, the outside approach and the inside approach?
It's the freedom, I think. Just the, you take away the walls and everyone just feels a little bit more free.
There's a lot more creativity, I think. They're free to explore because obviously not every school is different, but out here we sort of give them a rough idea and then they play with it. They do their own thing, whereas it's not,
it's
this is how you do it, copy me sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that's what I found at school. It was always learn to do it this way. This is how you do it. If you can't remember this, well, you might not pass your GCSEs. And I didn't. I was terrible at GCSEs. But here, we'll say, hey, we're going to make like a habitat tower or, you know, we're going to roast marshmallows or something. And we're not like, oh, okay, you know, no, turn it slower. No, 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 don't let it catch fire. None of that. You know, you learn.
Yeah.
They eat a burnt marshmallow. They might not like it or they might love it. So they'll, you know, or make a habitat tower.
So
this is the kind of things they like.
So they're definitely learning. They're learning by doing rather than learning by being told.
And learning through their interests as well.
Yeah.
You know, a passion comes from a love of an interest and that's what they get to do at forest school. You know, they come out and, you know, groups of kids that love building dams or building things, and they really, you know, and they roll with it and they do it and they become amazing at it, and then they have a real passion for it, and you know, they may go off to do really amazing things or they might not, but you know, at least they've had that opportunity. And I think the big thing about forest school is that a lot of it, you know, is child led. It's free, it's equal, you know, spend time talking and listening to each other, and just
keep
off on a rant.
Yeah. Well, no, that's fine. And I mean, there isn't a lot of talking to each other in school, if I remember rightly. There's mostly a lot of sitting quietly and listening to one individual talking.
Well, that's it.
But yeah, like you say, it's learning through doing as well. It's a very physical thing being outside, isn't it? You know.
And it is an important thing, the child-led thing, isn't it? Because you genuinely, I mean, as long as they're not going to do themselves any damage.
No.
And even then, elements of risk are accepted, aren't they? I remember hearing a BBC reporter go out to a forest school, and you could hear the horror in the voice as these children were running through a shrubbery or something, and they were just being observed by the forest school leaders.
Mm.
And they said, "Well, you know, well, the children obviously like running through that shrubbery, so perhaps we'll put a path through there, or get them to do it."
It's not
just child led in name. They genuinely are deciding what they want to do.
Yeah,
and then you make the best use of that.
Yeah.
Exactly, and they learn through that. They're learning the big thing about risk, and it is quite a big thing that they do. You do go over it a lot in the training, and you have to sort of battle with it sometimes when different groups come out. But it is, they are learning to risk assess for themselves. If they're constantly having that
dynamic risk assessment.
Yeah, they're constantly having that taken away, but they never have the opportunity to go, "Oh, actually, I don't feel comfortable going that high."
Yeah. Mm.
Then, you know, then you have children that come out and they'll shoot straight up a tree and then they fall out because they've never had the experience to test and try and actually get a real sort of gauge of what they're really capable of.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that's really, really important. I mean, we all did it when we were kids, you know, we were out and about running around.
It's the first thing everybody says, isn't it? "Oh, I remember when I was a kid, I did all this kind of stuff." First thing everybody says.
That's what I was going to say, was I remember climbing trees.
Says
and
it.
Actually, the climbing of trees was facilitated for us. It was made easier for us to get into the lower branches. And then, although I know it terrified my mum, she was happy to let us do it. And I know that's one of the principles of the forest school, isn't it? Is that these little people are all entitled to experience appropriate risk and challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, I mean, risk and challenge are two important words, but I guess appropriateness is as well, which is where your training comes in.
Well, there's a big thing I think is fear of litigation from certain teachers or something that want to take them out, and they would love to let kids do everything, you know, but the fear that something might happen and they will get sued or, you know, taken to court, all kinds of things, and it's really scary. I mean, the media scare the pants off of you on these kind of things, and you think, but hang on, you did it as a kid, why wouldn't you want your kid to do it, sort of thing, you know. It's hard. I mean, you know, we let kids climb trees and everything, but you manage the risk, you know, and you talk to the parents, you say, well, risk benefits, isn't it? Risk benefit assessment. And you said, this is what they're going to get out of it. Are you cool with us letting your kid climb a tree, you know? And if this happens, we've, you know, got all the qualifications to deal with it, first aid outdoors, all this kind of thing, and we will deal with the situation, but that kid will learn. If you never fall down, you never learn how to get back up again.
They are actually incredibly robust, aren't they?
They bounce.
Yeah.
Oh, they bounce.
Yeah, and very, very capable. I think people don't give them credit enough for what they're really capable of.
No, I think you're right, and that's another of your basic forest school principles, isn't it? Is that everybody is competent to explore and discover.
Hmm.
Yeah, sometimes they forget what dead branches look like and grab them as they climb in.
Yeah, and I guess, what do you do, kind of observe and then try and build on whatever it is you see them doing?
Yeah, it's just with tree climbing or
With their activities generally, because some of them, as you said to me yesterday, some of them just want to throw themselves face down in the mud.
That's a big thing for them, you know, and it's sensory, you know, it's sensory is fantastic. And but then there's another lad we've got, he's home education, and his mum told us that he will only sort of read Lord of the Rings and that kind of, and that's heavy reading. I mean, that's incredible. And he's only 10.
Yeah.
So he's got the ability to read, but he's not interested in reading anything else. So they were looking for somebody who would, you know, teach him bushcraft and everything. So she's a wonderful, enthusiastic mum. She's lovely. And so we got him into it, you know, and it's, and he's gone home and he's looking up, foraging, and he's writing his own foraging guides, and he's going out on his own, and he's logging things, and he's reading up, and because it's his interest. And it teaches simple things like perseverance. So I showed him what a pig nut was. We've got loads of them here. It's lovely. And
what's a pig nut for the listeners?
Well, a pig nut is, it's got a kind of white umbilifer type, white flower top and a small stem that goes down. But the problem with a pig nut, at the bottom of it is a tuber. But the pig nut doesn't make it easy for you. So the stalk will go down and down and down into the ground. But it won't be a straight stalk to the tuber. It will bend its way and it can go like an inch, 2 inches to either side, any direction. So you have to be really slow and careful, and you carefully tweeze the soil apart and you follow that tiny little thin, fragile root. And this boy was doing this and it took him about 20 minutes, half an hour. This pig nut was really deep in the ground. He didn't give up. And that's, you know, it's teaching him perseverance, and he got his reward at the end of it, you know. He washed it off and he ate it with glee, you know. Yeah.
What do they taste of? I've never seen a pig nut.
Like an unripe hazelnut a little bit. It's quite tasty, very fresh.
You'll have to dig one up later.
Yeah, we've got go for it. But it teaches perseverance, and that was his interest, you know. He was interested in it, so he pushed himself and he persevered and he attained his goal, you know, and he set that goal himself. You know, we didn't tell him he had to.
So, and it means that people don't, you know, if they have a love of reading or whatever, they don't have to sacrifice, it's not sacrificed in coming out here, it's actually enhanced. So some of their school learned skills, if you like, are broadened by being out in nature.
There's a lot of curriculum in the outdoors, you know, a lot of forest schools and residential camps, outdoor residential camps and everything. They do sort of send the teachers documents, stating if they do this activity, it covers, you know, key stage one of geography, or, you know, and it's wonderful. You know, teachers can tick boxes by sending their kids to the outdoors. So they get what they want, you know, and the kids get what they need, you know. Yeah. Everyone's happy.
So that's great. So it feeds back into the schooling system as well.
100%. 100%.
I guess in as far as they're leading their own play or exploration or whatever, your main aim is to actually discover their interests and then encourage their strengths and try and enhance any weaknesses they might have.
Yeah, I mean, I think observing them is a really valuable tool. You know, observing them and talking to them and spending time with them, and you really get to know the children, and then you can help facilitate their interests and help them build on them. By observing.
Yeah, and that's another important point about the forest school, isn't it? Is that it involves regular sessions.
Yes.
And it's, as I say, you see the progression in the kids. Yeah. As I say, our after school club, just incredible. Today's session was just...
great, yeah. I mean, changes don't happen overnight, do they?
No.
And that's the great thing about forest school.
But it happens quickly. It happens really quickly when you do forest school or they're in the outdoors. I think the change can happen a lot quicker than if they did it in other ways. Maybe.
Yeah, sometimes it can do, yeah, I think you're right.
I think I learned all of these sort of related skills and stuff when I was on scout camps, which I used to really enjoy. And there, you know, there was cooking and tree climbing and wide games and building fires and pitching tents.
And it's a credit to the people who do it, because obviously they don't get paid and they spend a lot of their time coming out. And there's a lot of people out there putting their heart and soul into outdoor education and getting, you know, the only gain they get is the seeing the kids nurtured, you know, nurturing the children and seeing them grow.
Yeah.
So it's a big testament to them.
Well, they can't be a much better feedback than that, than seeing the little ones growing up. And I guess
it's an excellent reward.
By getting them out here and getting them talking to each other and stuff, you're fostering one of the first things that your local roots
what's
project,
the catchline, Tiff?
is to foster community, isn't it?
Yes.
How long have you set that up?
Local Roots.
Mm.
Local Roots set up at the end of October last year as a small charity organisation, and we've started running sessions just at the end of April. So it's a real baby, really. Mm. Yeah.
we opened up with a massive community event, a big medieval day at Ashfield, and we sent about 40s a good turnout. We had 250 people turn up for our free medieval day.
And
the great thing, saying about fostering a love for community, I mean, this area is full of interesting, unique people with a lot of skills. And everybody flocked to the chat. We just said, I mean, I don't feel like we did too much to organise it.
You might not.
Hey, well, I was just like, okay, you teach archery, you know, the Radnor Foresters, wonderful. You do archery, would you be willing to come and run archery on the day? Yeah, cool, I'll be there. The Radnorshire Camera Group, they came there. The Powis Dance Group, they turned up and they ran a
theatre company as well.
One corporate fund turned up with a bouncy castle for us to use on the day for free. And I mean, the community really banded together and for no gain of their own. But at the end of it, they all gained something from it. They gained, well, the Radnor Foresters got more members, you know, the Camera Group more, you know, members and everything. It just amazes me around here how people will just very quickly do something to help kids. They really care.
I think that's really exciting because we're involved in a lot of things like community drama and what have you around here. But actually to pull together a load of community groups to work together, because it's quite possible that the Radnorshire Archers hadn't met the corporate fun people.
Yeah.
So it's Bouncy Castle's an archery, isn't it?
Yeah. Fair point. But on that occasion, they all got to see good results and hopefully they'll be willing to work together again. I mean, what a great launch for your project as well.
It was really exciting. Yeah. We all came out incredible. Of that absolutely buzzing.
And as soon as everybody left, we were straight on Bouncy Castle.
Oh, yeah. Shh, don't say that. Podcast
it. Yeah, corporate fun, you're not listening.
And did you have a donation bucket out?
No, we failed on that kind of thing. But, you know, it was a launch. We just wanted to show we're here, your community's awesome, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
That was our reward.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all we wanted, and that's what we got. And we've been doing community events ever since. So we just finished one with Play Radnor. Over 300 people turned up to that.
Yeah, we did National Children's Day.
Awesome.
A really, really good day. And the theme was play, so it was perfect for us to work in partnership with Play Radnor. It's really, really good.
We've got the Ashfield Summer Fair and there's all sorts going on, isn't there?
I mean, we go into the events and showing people who we are and what we're doing and getting the word out there, and it's nice to support other events. Like, they supported us, so obviously that's community, isn't it?
I think that's really great because, I think it's easy, even in a place where people are basically community-minded, it's easy to get so busy that you end up isolated.
We all work together, maybe just the Landod area, but there seems to be sort of, there's a group of people that you tend to see nearly all the charities, all of the committees and everything, and they are working so hard to try and make this place like what it deserves to be, you know. I mean, this Landrindod Wells is an incredible town, and there are some people just pouring their hearts and souls into the area and doing so many free events, and it's just lovely to be a part of that. And you genuinely feel like you're part of a community. So yes, we do this, and it can be hard at times, but you'll meet each other and you're like, I'm certainly not alone. There are a lot of people trying to just show everyone how great this place is.
Yeah,
they really are.
And I guess rather like with the children, actually holding things outside and in such a beautiful place as this, that in itself is going to encourage people to come and take part.
Yeah, definitely.
So you mentioned the after-school club. What sort of age are they?
5 to 12s.
Right, so that's quite a broad range, isn't it? Because 12s are 12s, which is really quite a developed youngster nowadays. And
Yes.
5-year-old, they can still be just toddling, really, can't they?
Yeah, well, you'd be amazed how nicely they play together.
Yeah,
and they just get on with it, and they all sort of mix together. We've got a really lovely group.
But that's another thing about being outdoors and playing. It takes all that superficial stuff from everyday life. It just takes it away and you become a kid again.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen them, like, inner city London kids who are awesome, you know, in the outdoors, and they'll be like, wearing the best Reebok trainers and all this kind of stuff as they walk into the woods for the 5 days and that. And they hate it when they get there. I tell you, after day two or something, they're little kids again. It's all out the window and they just become kids.
What about grown-ups? Do you get grown-ups coming along with them?
Yeah, we've got, for the after school club, we have a couple of volunteers that come along as well. And we've got one really enthusiastic mum, and she stays just because she loves it, which is really nice. Yeah. And yeah, it's really nice.
So they enjoy it as much as the children.
Oh, certainly. Mm. Yeah, they get just as muddy.
I know you, Jess, you, Synchro, you ran a course, didn't you, for people who were going to be having children in the outdoors, and you did exactly with them what you would have done with the youngsters, and they really enjoyed their day, didn't they?
Yeah, that was for the National Trust, and they were people who were working for the National Trust. They were National Trust staff, and they wanted me to show them what forest school was like.
Mm.
So I thought I'd just run a normal forest school day with these adults, and like you say, they didn't start behaving, you know, like kids straight away. But as soon as we got involved in the activities, we were making simple things like ash mallets, and we built a brash hedge, and they were in there as enthusiastic as ever. And a simple shelter we built, and they were using some techniques that maybe adults would know and children wouldn't, or something like that. But it was the best thing I could have done, I think, was just run it as a normal for a school session for adults. And I think it's just as applicable for adults as it is for children.
Oh, yeah.
Because they take it on a different level, maybe, but...
I went, when I did my training at the Bushcraft, it was just that we had it was 4 days, and they ran it as if we were the children at the camp. And it was so much fun. I mean, the probably other last year leaders were just, you know, tittering in the background, giggling at us.
Yes, I was.
It was amazing. It was so much fun. And I just remember having like the best time and just playing all those wide games and, you know, lighting the fire and doing all of these things. And I just felt really good. I was so pumped up at the end of it. I was just like, this is the best thing ever. Like, it's just awesome.
And the vast majority of people just don't get the opportunity or don't make the opportunity for themselves to do this. That's another thing that I like about crewing at the festivals, is it's a similar kind of gig, really.
Yeah.
You're out there in the outdoors doing stuff, you know, and sometimes it is lighting fires and other times it's, you know, whatever. But it really encourages a sense of community, and the outdoors really releases the spirit.
Yeah.
Even when the weather's a bit grim, has to be said, you know, because then you get the joy of when it clears up again.
Yeah, that's very true.
Or sitting around the fire with a hot drink. That is such a treat, you know, when you've been out all day and then you can come around the fire and it's lovely. And you sit and chatting with everyone. And
there's something about fire, isn't it, though? I can't remember the book, but I heard somebody say to me that fire was the reason our brains developed. Possibly because it was the first time we ever sat around and were social. So we tried to communicate with each other kind of thing. We tried to develop language because we had time, just a place and a time, and we had light to just sit and develop language. And there was another one that, said to me that basically obviously you could your food is cooked, so it's easier to digest, so your brain had more energy to develop other functions, so it developed your brain sort of thing. So there's all sorts of things. And you know, I say I've been doing this for over a decade now, and every single person I've ever met, no matter their background, anything, they will stare at a fire and they will happily look at it for a long time and they will not get bored.
Yeah,
it's impossible.
We've noticed that as well. In fact, I think you can get you can get like a fire screensaver for your flat screen TV now, so you can have
at Christmas.
You had an open fire burning on the television.
Yeah, with Christmas music. Yeah, bit of Nat King Cole.
Very good. No real fire here, so we'll have the closest.
Yeah,
thing.
Unfortunately.
I think another thing is that I think personally the ancients were correct when they said that everything is made up of earth, air, fire, and water. When you're in a city and you're never coming out and doing this sort of stuff, you're completely disconnected. You're wearing rubber-soled shoes, and anyway, you never walk on any soil because it's all tarmac. Fire is regarded as so dangerous that, you know, you're not even allowed to have a candle in a theatre anymore.
Oh,
you know, you think you have to have a little LED light in a jar or something like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you're in a city, you've got all of the cars and the buses, and the air's not particularly clean, and we won't even start talking about the water. Whereas instantly you get out here, I mean, we're all sitting with bare feet, with our feet on the mud, we've got a fire burning over there. The water over here doesn't have fluoride in it, a lot of it comes from boreholes. I don't know, what's the water source here? Is it mains?
Eland?
Ashfield is mains, yeah. It's nice water there. We get lovely water around here.
Is it from Eland?
I'm not sure.
It's the same. I think most of the Eland
water goes to Birmingham. Yeah.
We don't get our own water around here.
I'm not sure where our water comes from. What about home educators? Because we've talked a little bit about getting kids in from the school and stuff. Do you get home educators coming as well?
Well, we've got the mum that comes, and a lot of the home education kids, they just get on the bus and they turn up, don't they?
Yeah, we run two home educators groups. We have a younger under 10s group and an over 10s group.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they come out and on a Tuesday afternoon, and
yeah,
they're incredible.
So what's the sort of difference between what you do with the under 10s and the over 10s?
The under 10s is quite a young group, really, and that's why we decided to split it. And they, you know, the sort of parents of the older group had requested it as well, because it's in the younger group is a lot of families who are planning to home educate or have, you know, sort of 5-year-olds and then younger. And so what the older children wanted to do needed somebody there to be able to focus on them, and the younger children need it as well. So any sort of thing, they just need general sort of supervision when they're doing their thing and playing around. And then the older children want to ask a lot of questions and go really in depth and things, and they're really into their bushcraft and their skills and things like that. And you know, that's something that we can absolutely do.
And their parents are really passionate about their learning and who they're going to become. And I think, I mean, the parents we've met from home education, the children's education is very child-led. It's child-led education. This is what they're interested in. I'm going to take them to that club. You know, and they do. They've got a better social life than anyone I know, home educated kids.
Sure,
they're incredible.
They're ballet
and archery, just everywhere, doing everything.
You really notice the difference between the school and the state school and the home school, as it were.
There is a difference. I'm not.
I think it's obviously, you know, we're going to tread lightly.
Yeah.
Personal opinions, but I think home education, again, it's a difficult question actually. If they're home education and they're interested in the subject, they will go headlong into it, and they will really focus on it, and they will want to go in depth into the subject. You know, again, I can't speak for the younger home ed, because that's your group. But and the school groups, they're more willing to follow what's been said, sort of thing. They'll do what you ask them to do, and they will look to each other as to what to do next sometimes, kind of thing.
I think home ed kids seem to be really independent and
very independent. Yeah,
they just sort of get on with it. They don't wait. They don't wait to be told to do something. Sort of as children, as the school kids are, which sometimes is great, and sometimes, you know, they just sort of go, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Off I go, and they really just take responsibility for themselves and just go for it. You know, whereas I think sometimes the school groups sort of, they're a little bit more unsure, and they're not quite as comfortable as in just doing what they want to do, kind of a thing.
It's interesting that sometimes they look to each other for assurance as to what's going on next. It's almost as if they're looking for the closest thing they've got to an authority figure, given that there's no authority figures present.
Yeah, I mean, I think with time they change. I mean, they, like the after school club, isn't it? You know, they've progressed, and they just, like this session we literally just finished, they just go for it, you know, now. And yeah, I think it's there, you know. Obviously, you know, home ed kids and school kids are exactly the same, but I think there's a something once they realize nobody's going to tell them what to do necessarily, and once they've got to know a place better, they will just go for it. And they you know, I don't know. It's a hard question, and obviously one that, you know, we have no opinions on necessarily, you know. It's
I was watching a video last night about a thing called radical unschooling.
Oh, right.
And
okay.
The parents that I was watching now were describing exactly what you're describing. They said, you know, if whatever it was their children showed an interest in, then they would try to provide them with everything they needed to explore it fully.
Yeah.
We have a few parents in the younger group who were talking about that the other day, weren't they? They were saying we are very much unschooling.
Yeah.
That seems to be an up and coming thing.
I think it's like personal, like us as well. Like I didn't like school and I didn't do well at school. I don't know about you. Did you?
I think
so. I'm not.
I went to too many different schools. I don't know. I think it depended on the school. If, you know, some schools we had a bit more freedom, and if the teacher was nice, it just made a big difference, didn't it? But sitting down, real academic stuff wasn't what I ever enjoyed. You know, not to say I wasn't good at it, and that's not to say that children who are good at academic necessarily like it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I've met a lot of kids who at school are in detention a lot, or they are in, you know, they're always in trouble or something, or they don't go to class, or they back talk their teachers and everything. And when you talk to them, it's like, I just don't agree with what they're telling me. I just don't want to do what they're telling me to do. I don't agree with it. I don't understand why I have to do it, sort of thing. And then they come out here, as we were talking about local forest school leaders that we both know, you know, they, you know, work with pupils who don't enjoy academia, and they come out here and they thrive. Yeah. They are incredible at everything, you know, or they really put their, you know, socks into it, you know.
Their socks?
I don't know.
They're allowed to be individuals out here, you know.
That's a good way to put it.
It's okay to be whatever you are, and that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's...
And the children I've met who are doing that particular brand of forest school, the brand that's because they're basically not allowed into school, so they've got to find other things for them to do. I've met three or four of them now, I think, and I've been very impressed by their capacity for conversation, for rational argument. They seem to me to be very bright people, and they've probably got every reason for not enjoying what's going on at school. I mean, since I still think that, I mean, by the standards of the day, I got quite a good education, although I'm not going to go into what I think about it now. And I am aware from talking to children that school's changed a lot. We were taught to think and to reason and to sort ideas out and to try to convince other people of them and things. Mm. There was a degree of rote learning and stuff. I think there always is. But nowadays it does seem that people are just having... Well, you've got a national curriculum, which means that people everywhere from Redruth to Newcastle are being taught the same thing, and they're not the same people, they're not living in the same community, they haven't got the same interests.
No.
I think a big part of it is that everybody's a different kind of learner, and that's something that they go into in your forest school training, is all the different types of intelligences and all the different types of learners that there are in the world. And, you know, for some people love school and they do amazing when they're in school, you know, and that's one type of learner. And I think what's great about forest school is that because we spend a lot of time observing and really trying to get to know the children, that we can figure out what kind of a learner they are, and then how can we best help them to perhaps, through their strengths, work on maybe things that they might not be so good at.
Yeah.
It's incredible. I mean, I've just finished working for a company with young people up to 19 years old who are in care, and they are very high on the autistic spectrum. You know, they're 1-to-1, 2-3-to-1 care sometimes, occasionally very aggressive, and, you know, can't verbally communicate and everything. And, you know, in their school, you know, the teachers are wonderfully caring, passionate people, but they're still sort of teaching them to count to four kind of thing, you know. And the company hired me as their outdoor education coordinator, and thanks to all the wonderful people that have taught me in the past, I sort of had some activities to do with them. And, you know, these kids who are still learning to count to four, and they're 19, were using swords in the outdoors, and they were actually showing imagination and creativity and remembering. Like, I used to do a lot of horticulture with them, and after about two or three sessions, this one lad would like go straight to the area and start doing what was asked of him, but he couldn't remember how to count to four. And the outdoor, emotional behavior disorder, EBD, you know, can't stand being in a classroom, will not do academia, you know, will not sit in a classroom for long, will not do what they're told, very violent occasionally. If they are told what to do, get them outdoors, it all goes out the window, and they are cool with it. They are fine. I mean, you might have to chase them through a sort of riverbed or something, because that's where they want to go. But it's fine. They're not being annoyed. They don't care. You know, this one lady was fishing all the time. He loved fishing, you know, and he just wants to sit there quietly. He didn't want to be told what to do all the time. Do you know what? He could have been a world-class angler.
Yeah.
You know, and it, like we were saying about last night, with Ken Robinson and schools killing creativity against Ken's bag. But, you know, it's that whole thing of finding what a child is capable of, and if they're a really good dancer or a really good mechanic or they're a wonderful bushcraft instructor or something like that, you know, should we be focusing on that, or should we be focusing on teaching them things they may not necessarily use, you know?
The thing is, if you to use your example, if you're going to get into horticulture, especially if you're going to get into planting veg and stuff, you will eventually come to realise that you need to be able to count and measure and things like that.
The curriculum is in everything.
Every single vegetable has a different way, you know, it's going to grow to a different size. It's going to have to be planted a different distance from other things. And by definition, you've always only got a limited amount of space to plant each thing in.
Eventually,
your love of horticulture, I would have thought, like, I was really rubbish at maths. I quite enjoyed it. I understood it when they taught it to me.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, as soon as I got home, I couldn't remember it. But once I got out into a factory where I was actually having to calculate things and getting bought in and stuff like that, which I really loved. I really enjoyed that job. And then I started coming to grips with the maths and the arithmetic and stuff. But it wasn't until I had an application for it that I was really interested in overcoming my own difficulties with it. And I guess the same thing's true here. If you're finding people's strengths and playing to them, then eventually they'll learn, because some of these basic skills are basic for a reason. It's because they're integral to all sorts of things, and you're going to stumble across them.
Definitely.
So it's really, you're after not just, I guess you're not after just developing the children, you're after a kind of holistic development of everybody that comes along, be it carers, parents, children, and yourselves. You must be learning from the children too, are you?
Oh, yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a big part of it as well, as they talk about, you know, the reflective practice is not only for the children who come, but also for the leaders, you know, and reflecting on your own practice, on how you run the sessions and everything like that. It's really, really important. I mean, everybody should, you know, people need to have a sort of sense of self-awareness, and I think that can sometimes be very rare, and that's something that I hope to foster in the children that come to forest school.
Yeah. Do you find it helpful to work with other forest school leaders? Do they know different things and have different... Because if everyone's learning from the children, you're always going to have things to teach each other, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody's got, you know, everyone's had such different experiences, and it's just great to share, and, you know, and especially activities and things to do is people's brains are amazing, and other brains come up with such amazing things, and you think, oh yes, that is great, I want to try that. Yeah, I love it. I think it's a great way to improve and learn.
Yeah. So do you have a way of logging all these new experiences that you get, or do you just rely on your brains to...
No, we write down what activities we've done, and at the end of every session, we sit down for 5-10 minutes before they all go home, and we say, what would you like to do next week? And we work on that, and, you know, next week, you know, it might be building a roundhouse, or... it could be anything, you know. Yeah.
And then a lot of it is in your head, you know, you're going through, was that good? What could we do next time? And, you know, you just keep a sort of mental bank, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, I think as far as school leaders are not big fans of paperwork.
No, that's certainly one of the things I've noticed about them. What about your own sort of continuing professional development like? Is that obligatory? Do you have to do regular kind of upskilling courses and things like that?
I think you just want to after a while, don't you? I mean, you just get so deep into what you're doing, you know, you want to go on courses, you want to go and learn from other people, you want, that's an ember on my foot.
I don't think there's any kind of requirement. I think people just naturally do. In this field of work, I think they're, like Matt says, just want to.
Do you have a forest school leaders camp? You have one where you all go out and have some fun.
They have conferences.
I think that's just mid Wales. You just do that for fun as a kid, don't you? You become forest school leaders at a very young age around here, I think.
There are loads of things organised, lots of different networks. There's Forest School Wales network, and they put on lots of different training trainings and meetups and things like that. And then there's the Forest School Association, which is like everybody, and I think a lot of it in England as well. And then, you know, they do big conferences and meetups and trainings. And then even, you know, all the other forest school leaders and stuff. There's massive amounts of things that you could go to.
So it is kind of encouraging fractal community. So you've got your own local work here, and then the slightly wider scheme of the local forest leaders.
Yeah.
So you're actually encouraging wider communication, wider community.
Yeah. We've all got the same goal, really.
There's cluster groups as well. They wouldn't be happy with me if I didn't mention them. There's outdoor learning cluster groups.
I know Jess mentioned them a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're part of our local one, and they offer us support and anything that we need, we can go to them on advice for anything if we need to, and vice versa.
Yeah. So what about your rural traditional skills that you're hoping to foster? What kind of things do you have in mind for that?
Well, we're hoping to try and get some Heritage Lottery funding. And part of this fund is that the kids are involved in the application process. And we're hoping to do that with the Home Education Network. They're really excited about it and everything, so we're trying to come up with a project. And that could be anything from wattle daubing, it could be building the roundhouse, it could be, I mean, fence building, you know, like laying hedges, everything. Again, we've only been running the actual forest school for a month and a half now, so it's all early days, but there's so much we can do. And the beautiful thing about having our own site, and Asheville being so kind and generous and allowing us to, as long as we told them what we're doing, we can come and do it, you know, we could do anything here. I mean, it's conservation.
So how big is the site here?
Asheville is 7.5 acres, and we rent 1.8 of those from them.
That's quite a big area.
It is.
I suppose there's probably work needs doing on the wider site as well, so if you have an eye for something, you might be able to...
Yeah, I think with the rural skills, the sort of idea behind that is that we just really want to... They're getting lost, really, and we want, you know, to inspire the next generation to sort of, like, take an interest in it and possibly maybe want to do something with it, or just know that those things used to be done that way or still are done that way and still can be done that way, and it is a valuable thing to know, and that's the sort of...
I guess by encouraging a couple of hundred people to come here and even see the place, that's got to be the first move, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, something we really want to do is living history. I really want to do living history, and that involves a lot of rural skills.
So what sort of thing you thinking of building Neolithic structures and
stuff?
Lot of it's up to the Home Ed group, isn't it, really? They're the ones researching it and everything, and we'll go with it.
I have really fond memories of going to, like, an old school building, and we had to go collect water from the well and churn our own butter, and as a kid, just loved it. I thought it was the coolest thing ever, and I just couldn't, like, understand how anything could be cooler than that in the world. And I feel like there are got to be other kids around here that are going to want to do stuff like that and just properly immerse them in it. I would like those days to be sort of real, sort of full immersion, where everyone comes in costume, we do everything the way things were done, and no matter what period of time, as long as it was long ago.
So you don't have maybe not the 80s. We've been staying at a place where we've had the opportunity to milk a cow and make butter and make soft cheese and make hard cheese and all of that.
Really,
and it's lovely. Actually, it's just a really perfect way to start the day with your head in the flank of a warm cow. I mean, milking the cow is not a problem, neither is making the cheese. Convincing officialdom to let people eat the bloody stuff is something completely different.
Yeah, that's it.
It is.
You're all right to give it to weaning puppies.
Yeah.
But that's it. I mean, can you imagine a kid sort of, the feelings they're going to get and sensations by sticking their shoulder into a cow's rump sort of thing, and, you know, leaning in and feeling the boom of this animal and everything. It's massive, you know, and they're not going to get that in everyday life. And they're going to go away with their head higher, you know.
That is where milk comes from, and how do you make butter, you know?
Yeah. Kids understanding where food comes from.
Yeah.
That's a whole new bucket of worms.
Yeah.
And it is amazing how much milk comes out of a cow. I mean, four gallons a day.
Impressive.
I want a cow.
Jersey cow. 4 gallons a day.
Blimey.
3 or 4 inches of cream on top.
Oh, you calm yourself.
I mean, I thought it was crazy. Last year, when we went to this farm that we've been working on, it was the first time, as a country girl, it was the first time I'd ever milked a cow, first time I'd ever made butter. And how mad is that? You know, having lived in the countryside for most of my life, I'd never actually had those experiences before. Mm. It was as much of a thrill for me as it would be for anybody who'd never done those things before. And you were amazed, weren't you?
I loved it.
You took to milking the cow like after water.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yes, it seems that sometime before I've managed, I've been milking cows because I just did. I really enjoy it. And it doesn't always come naturally, apparently. But
I've milked a goat before. Yeah. And just
Is like you're saying about the professional development. You're going off to a goat husbandry.
Goat husbandry
course this weekend.
I'm so excited.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, so it's those kinds of things you think, oh yeah, I'd love a go at that, you know. And
do you think there might be the opportunity of having some animals here?
I don't know, but
I really, really want them. I've got this real dream of having, you know, the chickens and the goats, and that being something that the children can experience as well. Used to be a small holding.
Yeah, of course.
So how's the other, I mean, if you've got 1.8 acres, it's 7.5. How's the other 6 acres kind of run at the moment? What's in it?
Oh, it's all, they've got 4 polytunnels where they do lots of growing. They've got a fruit cage. It's cultivated and, you know, for fruit, veg, herbs and plant production.
Yeah.
And they have allotments for the local people as well you can use.
Are they popular?
Yeah, actually.
There's a lot up there.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot up there, and some are better than others. Ours are not great.
My bamboo canes are bigger than the rest of them. May not be anything growing on them, but...
But yeah, they offer a lot of opportunity for people. Like we came in and now we are able to run this here.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've got training rooms and places to put on workshops. They have a community kitchen that's open for anybody to use. They do sort of Skillshare classes in the kitchen where, you know, people can learn about preserving and making sauces and using all the glut from the kitchen garden that they have up there as well. So
incredible
resource that they do, really.
But again, I guess the more people you can encourage to come here, the more likely it is that those things are going to get used more fully.
Yeah,
and that's what we really would like. Yeah, we really would like to.
Well, again, it was like the medieval day. Everybody benefits from each other. If we come together, everybody benefits, you know. Sometimes it just takes, you know, you've just got to bite the bullet, get your head down and work your butt off and get everybody together, and then the sense of achievement afterwards for yourself, you know, let alone what everybody else feels. It's incredible.
And also, the children having been out here, they've already started to show an interest in growing. Wants to plant seeds, went around watering all the trees today, you know, and that was a big thing that we were hoping to achieve by doing this here. You know, we could have done it anywhere. We could have done it in any woodland that would let us, really. But we chose to do it here, you know, with an aim of also helping Ashfield, hopefully getting some young people interested in growing and being really passionate about it.
A place like this, like we were saying in Oxford, wow. I mean, it would be swamped, wouldn't it? I mean, it would be very expensive to use as well, probably. But it's here, and people have got the opportunity.
Yeah.
So we just really hope more people learn about it and come here and do things, and it's incredible. They've got a smoking machine.
And a dehydrator.
Got it all. They've got it all. The wood workshop,
Yeah,
it's incredible.
So more or less, whatever you can imagine, it's actually everything already equipped here to do. How are you planning on extending? Because horticulture is another thing that you'd like to be encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I think next week.
Yes. I think we've got what we think we'll do is have a local roots allotment for the children, and you know, if we're whatever session it is we're running, schools or home ed or after school club. If they're showing an interest in it, then we can go up there, you know, and once it's established, then they'll hopefully want to keep it up. And yeah, we'll have it up at the top. And this area over here is meant to be somewhere that wasn't ever meant to be cultivated, so we won't do it here. We're going to do it up the top.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense to the listeners up the top, but I know what I mean.
my experience of children is that they really love gardening. They really do. They like the worms and the beasties and getting their hands dirty and getting wet and playing with hose pipes. And they love watching seeds grow.
Yeah.
And they're more likely to eat things that they won't normally eat if they've grown them themselves as well.
Yeah.
And who can blame them?
Yeah, I mean, I just want them to grow stuff and go, yes, I agree with that, and I'm going to cook it up and I'm going to eat it, you know, cook it on the campfire and...
Yeah, and getting them dirty
just
is the
whole,
bit.
You know, the whole process, full cycle. Just love it.
Mm. And what about the bushcraft? You're going to develop some of that here as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, as I say, I mean, the couple of home ed boys we get, we're actually working on writing a bushcraft book together because... I've been doing bushcraft for kids for like 6-7 years or something. There are some fantastic books out there, but what I really want to do is me write this book with the boys and we learn together and they, you know, okay, so we can write this paragraph. How are we going to do that? Do you understand this? You know, is it? And it's incredible. Like, and you see the mess here. You know, we built bow drill sets the other day with 10-year-olds from, a special education unit at a local school, and these boys, they created a bow drill ember, and they're 10.
Yeah.
They're 10, and they made a bow drill ember. And, you know, I've trained fully grown, very large, strong men to do bow drill, and they have been crying on day 2 because they still can't do it.
Mm.
You know, it's just, it's mind-blowing. Funny, you know, and it's the most primitive thing you can do. It's the first thing, make a fire from rubbing sticks together, and they did it, and they're 10. And they're, you know, special education sort of, you know, whatever. But, you know,
it is one of the things I like is that youngsters do get to encounter fire and they get to encounter knives and saws and that kind of stuff. And it's a matter of helping them to use them safely.
Yeah,
it can
and
do
them
it.
For
you
what
manage
they're meant
risk.
For. You know, understanding what they're for.
Yeah.
Well, that's
to
it.
Keep you warm, to cook your food, to whittle something that you might need.
Yeah.
You know, rather than...
Mm. Well, that's it. I mean, I've worked with a group of children who, you know, they have stabbed each other and things like that. And we gave them knives. It's an independent thing I did. And they got the knife and there was the original sort of, you know, shank, whatever. And by the end of it, they realized, oh my goodness, this is a tool. I can make awesome things with this. Yeah, it started out with spears and things like that. And okay, right, let's make a Dutch arrow. Well, you've got the skills to make a spear. Let's make a Dutch arrow. And then you go into the history of it, you know, Native Americans and everything with spear buffalo, like water bison with all this kind of thing. And then you can go on to other things and like they, you know, we made mallets and all kinds of stuff. And it's just, I don't know. Sorry, you can get me on the soapbox now.
No, it's cool because I'm thinking that, you know, when you take the standard media and stuff, you don't really get to see knives being used for anything.
No.
Apart from an offensive weapon.
Yeah, and they're really not.
Same with guns, actually. They're only ever used as an offensive weapon. You don't ever see people using them effectively as a defence or as a means of, you know, getting something that they're going to be able to eat or anything like that. And it's interesting to think that these ideas of the usefulness of such a thing just doesn't occur to people until they encounter it.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, that's the great thing about forest school training and everything. You can show them it has a use. This is what it's for. This is its purpose. It's not for stabbing someone. It's not for showing off or anything like that.
And presumably some of these youngsters are going to get interested in coming here as volunteers and helping out on days when they're not coming to forest school.
Well, we've already got a little volunteer, haven't we? A lovely young lady. She's 17 years old, and I was very lucky to meet her 5 years ago when I first came here and erratically helped the scouts, you know. And to see her grow through the scout movement and everything, you know, and to now, and she's so interested in doing, volunteering for us and helping young people, you know, children, use the outdoors to their benefit, and you know, and she's already decided she's going to create a YouTube channel, and she's going to go to different places that work in the outdoors and everything, and spend a few days with them, interview them, create a YouTube playlist of different jobs that you can have when you leave school. You have no idea what you want to do? Okay, look at this YouTube channel. This is a teenager's perspective. Here's me having a go at it. Here's what they say you can do. Here's what the prospects are, you know, and all sorts of cool jobs in the outdoors, you know, and that's because she's been in the outdoors and learned from a young age.
Yeah, but it helps
awesome.
To, drive initiative and...
Yeah.
That's what, that's the idea.
That's fabulous, that, as well, because that's connecting the technology with the outdoors, actually using the one thing to help the other, because I know it can be a bit difficult to prize the technology from their unwilling grip to start with, can't it?
Well, social media
Getting them out in the first place. Come on, you know you're going to love it.
It's a funny thing, because social media is... I mean, we've got a bit of word of mouth in here, obviously, small community, but social media is a big tool that, you know, Tiff's incredible at it, and we use it. And it's a wonderful way of people seeing what we do as well. You know, you look at a picture, and, oh, that's cool, yeah, I'll have a, you know, this beautiful picture of this young girl in the tree, and she's massive grin and everything, and people say, oh, I'm going to send my kid there.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a powerful, powerful tool.
It's very powerful.
It really is. It's, you know...
Great power comes in.
What about cooking? Do you do any cooking with them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What sort of stuff do you...
Banana breads, and they love their s'mores, but for everybody out there, there's no need to use just normal chocolate digestives. Get the ones with caramel in them as well. Oh.
Yeah.
Just make sure it's near, just before you give them back to the parents, you know.
Yeah, we've done the classic marshmallows, and we cooked chocolate cake and banana cake. They're enjoying cooking cakes in the
flapjacks.
Dutch oven. Flapjacks and...
Yeah, I mean, we don't cook any meat products or anything yet. I mean, if we did a long overnight camp and everything, and obviously you need different meet certain standards to be able to do that, so we haven't got to that stage yet.
No, but I mean, eventually. It's something that we've done in the past, in past jobs and stuff.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's a really nice thing to do, and I would like to do that with the children and, you know, get them off cakes and get them cooking some real meals.
They come out
but
with
we get them for quite a short time, really, you know.
Yeah, it's only two hours at a time.
So you're hoping to do the overnight camps?
I'd love to, yeah. I mean, the Home Education Network are very interested in doing a three-day residential somewhere else in a big woodland or something like that, and teaching them and starting, pie in the sky at the moment, but starting from, I would teach them Stone Age technology. A wonderful friend of ours from Outback to Basics, they... are going to train us in primitive technology, and they're going to teach us the Stone Age, and then I'll move them up Iron Age, Bronze Age, all that kind of thing, all the way up to medieval, and we'll go to a castle nearby and build catapults, and you know, they can test us while we're in the stock, so hopefully we'll get the answers right.
There's a friend of ours who builds trebuchets for lobbing potatoes.
Yeah, I would like to meet them.
he's a lovely guy. He's a bit of a science fiend, and yeah, we
awesome.
He brought it along to the Pendlandoli Apple Day, and we all had a go at lobbing potatoes into the orchard.
He teaches kids.
He does.
I'd love to meet him.
Home tuition and stuff.
Yeah,
and they do all
wonderful.
Sorts of science experiments with him and.
Ooh, really, so many incredible people out there.
We'll have to put you in touch with him.
Please,
I would love that. That would be great.
And what about you're starting to do a bit of stuff up at Mellowcroft as well? I was quite interested by the idea of these short retreats.
We're doing a teen girls retreat, which is something that I really, really wanted to do, because I remember what it's like to be a teenager, and it is really bloody hard. So we came up with the idea of doing these sort of mini retreats. We're going to call it Chicks in the Sticks. And, you know, it's just going to be a really nice, relaxed sort of girls hanging out, and, you know, we're going to do a bit of natural skincare, and we're going to do some Indian head massage with them, and there's going to be a workshop every time. And hopefully at the end of it, if we can get enough interest, we will do an overnight camp of just sort of a full sort of 2 days girls retreat. You know, we'd do all the campfire cooking and everything like that with a little bit of girliness, and just getting the girls out in, you know, somewhere really relaxing and outdoors, in, you know, back to nature. You know, there's a lot of pressure to be a teenager just in general, but I think especially for girls, you've got your Instagrams and your selfies and your Snapchats, and I just think that stuff follows them around all day long, and I think they really, really would benefit from having the opportunity to have that sort of having that escape to go and go, okay, actually I'm okay without it now, and I'm just gonna hang out and sunbathe with my mates and under the trees, you know. I think that could be something that they really, really would benefit from.
I think that's a great idea. Your website is
www.local-roots.co.uk.
yeah,
roots is in the tree.
Yeah, well, I'm going to subscribe to your newsletter so I can be kept up to date. Obviously we move around a lot, so we're not always around when things occur, but I'd love to, because community is something that I really like to help to foster, and I think communication between us is a really good thing to encourage, and it sounds like that's happening as well. I'd really love to be part of it and to help out, and I could learn a lot as well.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. We can learn from you guys as well.
Yeah, we've already learned loads from you in just one evening and today.
Well, I'd love to work with you, share,
oh,
you know.
Oh, yeah, we'd love it.
Share whatever we've got to share, you know. Can,
yeah.
Because I haven't done a lot of kind of forest school type stuff recently, and I'd love to get my hands back in.
Oh, well, you're welcome anytime.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Very good. Well, thank you very much for that. I think that was a very, very interesting chat, personally.
Oh, thank you.
Extremely personable and relaxed. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you. I look forward to seeing what you're doing.
Oh, cheers.
Dr. Rock's radio show, Seeking Solutions, on peoplesinternetradio.com.
There we go, Johnny Cash and A Boy Named Sue. And before that, Spirit of the Age from Hawkwind's Quark, Strangeness and Charm. A really cracking lyric, I think, that one. So, blimey, this all looks to be a lot louder than it was before. Maybe, yes, of course, it's because I tweaked it a little bit. There you go. Hopefully I'm not shouting too loud down your ears. I'll just back off my new microphone a bit and see how that goes. So, I really enjoyed meeting Matt and Tiff, partly because they are just so enthusiastic and because they're doing things which I heartily enjoy doing myself, and Synchro too. We kind of share a lot of ideals and activities with those two people, and I'm really hoping that we'll be able to work with them a bit, as you heard there, in the future. I think there's plenty to be done out at Ashfield. I think it really is. I mean, it doesn't sound like much maybe to people in towns to be actually attracting 40 people or so to an event, but round here it can be quite difficult because like I say, of the distances involved, there's generally a lot of diesel, plus the fact I think that there's really not necessarily a lot of money out here, and so people find it a bit hard. But to get 40 people for a tree planting day, and so they planted 300 trees. I'm a bit surprised they didn't plant any fruit trees, didn't get round to asking that question, but then I guess it's kind of, they'll maybe well get round to that afterwards, or maybe there's fruit trees out at Ashfield anyway. But so they got 40 people out for a tree planting day, including extremely small people, and as I've said many times before, the best way of getting to know people is to actually work with them. And as much as anything, almost any kind of workshop or activity day or that kind of stuff, whilst the reason you're there is to do a specific job, I always think that, or find myself, that one of the most amazing things about it, almost whatever it is I go and do, is the actual group of people. It's the dynamic between the people, the communication that happens, all of the help and the love that occurs. It really is quite extraordinary, and almost irrespective of whether you're doing spiritual work like ceremony or meditation, or physical work like planting trees, almost whatever it is, it's when people come together. It's the actual coming together of people that really makes a difference. And as for their admittedly free medieval day, but as for their medieval day, which attracted a couple of hundred people, that is really awesome. You know, to get that many people in one place, and so many different interests as well. Powis Dance is a really amazing organisation. They had people with cameras, they had the guys teaching archery, they had even had the corporate fun dudes right up from the other end of the scale who do all the bouncy castles and all manner of other things for people in corporations to have some fun. But to get all of those people together in one place, and I shouldn't think that, as I said in the conversation there, I shouldn't think that a lot of those people, even though we're pretty much sort of, you know, local to each other, I shouldn't think a lot of those group had actually met each other. And one of the things that's definitely been going on over the last, well, I don't know, whatever, however long the social media has been around, the last 15 or 20 years or so, is that there's a lot of interesting networks of people arising, a lot of specialties. People's internet radio is just one of these things, of course. Many of the people here have been together for some 4 or 5 years or so, but there are now special interest groups of one sort or another all over the place, and it has been my great hope that we'll not only see the digital networks actually meeting each other in physical space, because I think that meeting eyeball to eyeball and raising a pint or sitting around a fire or singing some songs or just chatting, whatever, is really important. I think it's good for us to know each other on the internet. I really don't think we'd be getting very far without it. But I think it's a wholly different thing to be actually meeting in the flesh, as it were. But another thing that I think I'm hoping to start, in fact, I think we are starting to see, is we're starting to see networks of networks coming together now as influential people from one group meet another group. And I think that that's where we're going to see an increase in communication, increase in cooperation, and hopefully an increase in the kind of progress we're making in this modern world to try and reassert some sort of control over our own lives, and perhaps some sort of attempt to make sure that the public servants remember that they're servants and get to recognise who their masters are. But really, that sounds like the medieval day, sounds like it was an incredible event. One that I would have loved to have been to. We were invited there, but we were previously committed, as they say. The child-led education sounds like a great idea, at least in principle, but it's amazing how mellow you need to be to get away with that. So there's a bunch of kids, as we heard there, who these little people, they really just don't want to leave the stream. There's a beautiful stream there. They've had volunteers have come along and built a little bridge over it. They've got a kind of island in the middle of the stream, which they're going to turn into a music island. It's right on the border of the Forest School patch. And apparently some of the wee ones really just don't want to leave the stream. And that's absolutely fine by the people at the Forest School. If you want to stay down by the stream, you stay down by the stream. So there's a lot of children there who really like building dams, and so that's what they do. And then there's another lot of children who come along and they really like taking dams out again, and that's absolutely fine as well. So you've got a kind of perfect balance there between one group and the other. It's perhaps a little bit more difficult when you put a lot of effort into building a wattle and daub roundhouse with one group of small people, and then another group of small people decide to come in and take it apart. But there you go. That is... the way of it. The children really do lead what goes on there. If one of them, as I mentioned there in the conversation, if one of them wants to come in and just throw himself face down on the mud, then that's absolutely cool. Whatever it is they want to do, basically the training of the Forest School leaders and facilitators, whatever we want to call them, is to observe and really let them get on with it, and try and use whatever their enthusiasms are to, improve their strengths, and to maybe work as a result of that on the weaknesses, so that there is an emphasis on the interest. What the children actually want to do is what is actively encouraged and what is facilitated and what is actually resourced. And as we heard there, sometimes quite often in fact, the experience of the great outdoors encourages use of what might be regarded as indoor skills. So it's often said that children spend a lot too much time on their computers and things like that. But when you develop an interest in, say, bushcraft or whatever it is out there, planting, then there's a lot of research to be done. Some children really enjoy reading to the point where they don't get outside a lot, just sit there inside with a book or maybe with a Kindle nowadays, I don't know, perhaps children still read books. But when a real life interest is generated by something outside and you've got enthusiasm of people around you to try and develop a project, then the inside and the outside work can become one, and they become a kind of mutually beneficial exercise. It makes use of the enthusiasms and skills of the children, and enables these two things to be knitted together. I think the point about children mixing and playing together was really important as well. As they said, they had, was it in their after-school club? Can't remember what the connection was, that some of the children were 5 years old and the oldest ones were something like 12, which is quite a big difference now. And yet they play together perfectly happily. And I've seen that. I see that at festivals. It's one of the things I really like about the festivals I go to, is there are a lot of children. They tend to be fairly family-based. And seeing groups of children, everything from the very smallest to really quite big, quite big children, all playing together happily, and hearing the noise they make is really marvellous. It's a sound that used to echo through the centres of all of the villages in these islands, and now, of course, most of the villages are silent. It's something we get to hear at festivals. It's something I noticed, to tell you the truth, even more at the slightly wilder gigs that we used to go to, the raves that were held on in hilltop forests and things like that, where, to be honest, most of the adults, at least for some of the time, were not probably really capable of paying too much attention to what was going on beyond their dancing and whatever else it was they were getting up to. But the children kind of used to move around in really quite large tribes, and they were having as much fun, I guess, as their grown-ups were. And I don't really remember anybody taking any serious damage as a result of that. And of course, the standard school system does stream people together, not only in terms, it seems, of competencies, but definitely in terms of age. Once you enter the standard school system, you will, by and large, be with people who are plus or minus, say, a few, 9 months from you, maybe a year. And that's where you'll stay for all of that time in school. You will be with the people who are your same physical age, apparently, of course, as they're told. And perhaps a mixture would be a much better idea. It's actually one of the things that was brought to light in the unschooling little documentary that I watched. I think it was a lady called what was her name? That's right. Her name was Dana Martin. This is the one. It was an Anarchast thing on YouTube. Here we go. Here's the link in here. It's called Anarchast episode 59, and it was the Martin family radical unschooling in Anarchapulco was what it was called, and I found it really quite a refreshing and interesting little 25-minute documentary. And what that lady was saying was that they, in her family, what they try to do is they try to resource whatever it is that the child's interested in. So there isn't a criticism of doing things like playing video games or whatever it is. What there is, or Lego or anything, what the child was interested in was what was encouraged and resourced, and the adult members of the family would do their absolute best to resource whatever it was that was going on. And this sounds like a really cracking idea, but one of the points that Dana made was that actually being only with people of your own age is not necessarily always advantageous. She brings up the example specifically of puberty, where really where you want to be quite possibly is with adults or grown-ups, with people who can actually give some sort of example of and explain a little bit about what it is that's going on. From my own perspective, I think I'd also point out that by separating one age from another age in school, what's encouraged, as far as I could see, is a culture of bullying rather than a culture of cooperation. That's certainly what I experienced, and I know that a lot of my friends did in the schools that they were in as well. Some really amazing stories there, which I've heard many times, really, from the various forest school practitioners I know. One of the ones that Matt quoted there was that he'd worked with some autistic people who sometimes required 3-to-1 caring, which meant that, you know, for each one small individual, there are three big individuals trying to police the situation. These people are occasionally violent, especially when somebody is trying to tell them what to do. Now, I think we can all understand that there are ways of getting people to do things, and there are ways of not getting people to do things. And some people, I guess, really don't like being ordered about. And of course, one of the things we reckon recognise on People's Internet Radio, where we are seeking sovereign solutions, is that no man really actually has the right to tell any other man or woman what to do. And perhaps it's just, perhaps part of the thing is that these people recognise that and are perhaps a little bit more reactive against it than others. But once you get them outside and start teaching them useful skills to do with saws and setting fires and things like that, instead of just trying to teach them to count to four, you can find yourself with quite a personable and dealable with individual, maybe a little bit more wild than your orthodox small person, but nonetheless not the kind of individual that seems to be being revealed when they're inside. Only told a story about 10-year-olds being able to start a fire with a bow drill. Now, I don't know whether any of you out there have tried that. That is a very difficult job indeed. I've met people who can probably start a fire in 60 seconds or so using that technique, but they've been a bit few and far between. And as he said, he's been trying to teach grown men to do that, who after day two are actually in tears with frustration that they're trying to do something that, well, I mean, I wonder how they'd feel if they knew that 10-year-olds could just kind of pick it up. It also reminded me of one of Synchro's stories of one of the forest school groups she had. One of the important things about the forest school idea is that these people come along for regular sessions, that it's not just one experience of the woodland, that there's enough time for the forest school practitioners to get to learn the get to know the children, get to learn what their weaknesses and strengths and enthusiasms are, so that they can encourage them and enhance their experience. And Synchro had a set of very little ones. I think they were, I don't know what they were, they were from whatever would be called junior school, but I think they were at the quite young end. And the idea was they were going to do 6 forest school sessions in all, and 5 of them were actually out in a piece of ancient oak woodland, again just outside Llandrindod Wells. Very, very beautiful place with ancient oak trees, ash trees, anemones and bluebells, and it's got hares in it, these great big old hares and rabbits, and it's full of mice and other smaller rodents. It really is an amazing place to spend some time. And for 5 weeks, that's where these little people came to. And all of them were, apparently, they were, what's the word, statemented. They were recognised as having different needs, differently enabled people. And so each one of them came with a carer, or with somebody who was there to look after whatever their needs were. But by and large, in the woods, these wee people were, to all intents and purposes, completely normal. And the grown-ups could sit around a fire and drink tea or whatever it was. And Synchro was saying that it was more or less impossible to say why it was these people had actually been statemented. But when week 6 came and the time came to have the concluding forest school session actually in the building, she said then it became apparent why it was that the carers were around and just exactly what it was that was difficult about these children. So I think I'm forced to ask myself, how much trouble is actually being created for individuals and for so-called society simply by keeping people inside, by isolating people from nature, and especially by herding people into cities. There's quite a lot of parks and stuff in London, and I guess there's parks in cities throughout the islands, but it's not the same as being out in the countryside. It's not quite the same as being next to a stream that's been running through a wood for thousands of years. These ancient woodlands are only there because they're by and large on very steep slopes and are impossible to actually difficult to harvest with machines, shall we say. You probably could harvest them if you want to, but they've stayed there because they're difficult to get at, and they feel different. Really, when one walks into these places, you can feel the calm of the trees and the age of the place descend upon you. It is not at all the same thing as a park, however big it is, that is surrounded by traffic and sirens and has only been there maybe for, 100 or 200 years if you're lucky. So I think that several times we heard Matt and Tiff talking about the fact that once children get outside, once they're in this kind of woodland settlement, they might be a little bit excitable for the first week or so, and they might be manifesting a lot of the behaviours that they would manifest if they were in the schoolyard or whatever. But within 2 or 3 weeks, they're really into it. I think they were also very discreet, obviously, in the comments they made about the difference between home-educated and school-educated children. And there was a slight emphasis on the fact that maybe the people from school were more likely to do what you told them to do, or more likely to wait for an authority figure of some sort to give instructions, whereas the home educated might be a little bit more willing to act off their own initiative and that kind of stuff. But in the end, once they'd been out sharing the woodland experience, lighting the fires, cooking the marshmallows or whatever for 3 or 4 weeks, then there wasn't really any distinguishable difference between them. So again, it might be worth, you know, I suppose it's very difficult if you're dealing with a very big school with thousands of children in it and maybe a lot of disillusioned teachers and all the rest of it. It might, well, I guess it's impossible, isn't it, to even begin to imagine child-led education under those sort of circumstances. There would be all manner of chaos. I think, though, in the 60s and 70s, there were schools that tried that sort of thing with varying degrees of success. And as for enabling us to get out into the woodland and to be out in the countryside and all that kind of stuff, I've been staying recently with a man who used to work for the local county council, and so he has a lot more information about what's actually going on and how things are assessed and charged and all the rest of it. And I've learnt a lot by talking to him, and it would appear that there's a huge disparity between the costs of people who live out in the countryside and the people who live in cities. So, for example, about 10 years ago in this county, or actually unitary authority as it is, something like 4 pence of the money that was spent on the people out here per pound was raised locally, and the other 96 pence came from the local mind control team in London, or I guess nowadays probably comes from Cardiff, which meant that we're not regarded as paying our way. It apparently costs something like £1,000 a year to put an individual through education in somewhere like Birmingham, whereas it costs £3,500 to do so out in the country. And the same is true for the maintenance of the roads and all these other things that apparently need to be done to keep us going. And by and large, the logical conclusion of all of this is that people who haven't got any money, people who really can't afford to pay their way as local government withdraws, are going to have to find themselves living in cities. And only the people that can really genuinely afford to live out in the countryside and pay their way are going to be out here. And that's going to, rather than getting more and more people to have the opportunity of experiencing this kind of thing and all of the benefits that it involves. And as we heard, it's not just ephemeral benefits. It really makes people different. Quite difficult people can be a lot easier to deal with. They can make a lot more progress. They can become a lot more self-sufficient simply by being given the opportunity of being outside and doing things that they regard as useful. No doubt it improves your temper no end doing that sort of thing. And what a great way of spending your time. I think probably it's even out here it's quite difficult to make any sort of living doing the forest school stuff, but the folk who are doing it actually want to continue developing their skills. You know, I'm well aware that people who are electricians and gas engineers and people in the health and safety executive and all this kind of stuff, they kind of have to go through continuing professional development, people in the medical realm, all that kind of stuff. And it's sort of expensive, you know, you have to spend a few hundred quid a year getting your latest certificate and your latest course. Otherwise, you'll find yourself probably not being able to make your money. But to actually be doing something where you want to develop your skills, where you want to go out and have a little bit more of it. And I think there's probably a lot of sharing between the various forest school leaders as well, because the children are going to be different. What the children do is going to be different. There'll be different games to be played, different things to be read. So every time you meet another forest school leader, there's going to be things to be learnt, which is an observation I've made many times about gardening, is that gardeners are not tight with their information. When two gardeners meet, they actually they actually share information, you know, because it's in everybody's benefit that good practice and good knowledge is shared from one person to another. I really like the idea as well that they want to be developing a few of the old traditional skills that they're after doing, some roundhouse building and hedge laying and fence building, especially hedge laying. In fact, you know, to a certain extent, the two things go together. Hedges are one of the finest habitats that we've actually got in the countryside. Laid hedge provides a place not just for birds, but for critters to live under the hedge and things like that. And if you've got a bit of fencing skill as well, you can actually do what they were doing out in Plotgate outside Glastonbury, where you can plant yourself a natural mixed hedge with lots and lots of indigenous bare root plants. And then you can build yourself a fence, kind of a metre or metre and a half either side of it. And that gives the hedge time to become really, really thick. And the thicker it is, the more things can live in it. Also, as we heard when we were talking to Chris Evans on the show about permaculture the other week, boundaries between one place and another, edges, margins, are the most fertile place for all manner of things to occur. It's not the open spaces that do all the variety, it's the spaces in between. So once you've got a hedge that's kind of 3 meters wide, you've got the edge between the field and the hedge, or the stream and the hedge, or whatever it is, and you've got the hedge itself, which is 3 meters wide. Then you've got another edge on the other side of the hedge. One of them is likely to be very sunny, the other's likely to be really sheltered. And all of this gives different plants and different animals the kind of potential for existing, which is currently, as hedges are grubbed up, improperly maintained and generally scraped in the autumn season. All of these opportunities are currently being deprived, removed from the landscape. So it's not only the people that would be benefiting from learning these traditional skills. There's lots of other things that would benefit as well. So the Ashfield complex is a great sounding place, and it's very beautiful as well. It's got plenty of land, it's got allotments, it's got a community kitchen, it's got big polytunnels, it's got workshops. And since the demise of the Radnor small holding project, which I was talking about earlier, where all of these people were working together to help each other out, since the demise of that, it's been a bit underutilized, not because people haven't been trying, but it would be really marvellous to see this kind of local resource actually taken advantage of. And as I say, really just by attracting people to the place, Matt and Tiffany are increasing the possibility that people will find a use for it, that people will gather there. Really look forward to seeing how it goes. I love the idea of the young lass as well, of going around to various forest school groups and finding out what people were doing out in the woods, what people were doing as a result of their forest school training, and making little YouTube videos as a kind of like a series of job prospectuses, if you like, the kind of things that you might do if you considered going out into the wilds and trying to make a go of it. As I say, we have to see if we can't find some way of actually connecting some sort of transfer of meaningless promissory tokens in exchange for all of this stuff, because by and large a lot of it is actually externally funded one way or the other, rather than necessarily directly funded by the people who are participating in it. We also heard Tiff talking about some little mini retreats that she wanted to run at a place called Mallowcroft. I'm really hoping to speak with Eddie, the man who set up Mallowcroft, which is another really beautiful project. He's worked very hard on his planning and all that kind of stuff, and has tried to meet the county council kind of head to head. I realise that it's been going on for a very long time, and I've not spoken to him for a year or so, so I'm not quite sure how it's working out. But hopefully we'll be catching up with Eddie at some point, and we can talk about what's going on out there as well, because in a way it's a similar kind of project. Another very beautiful place which is endeavouring to encourage alternative activities, community, in a beautiful and productive setting. So there you go, a place that is not only drawing its own little community round the forest school, but is actually one way or the other occasionally attracting communities of communities. They're planting trees, they're growing and cooking food, they're learning how to use fire and start fire, they're learning how to use tools and what they're for, they're communicating, they're sharing. and there's adults and their offspring sharing and enjoying the same activities. I know it's difficult at this time, but I really can't think of a more optimistic and upbeat project that I've come across of all the things I've seen recently, with two people with more verve and enthusiasm for getting it together. So I really look forward to seeing how that goes, and I really hope we'll get the opportunity to have Matt and Tiff. They've been there, like they said, since October. They've been doing the Forest School for the last 5 or 6 weeks. I really hope this turns out to be the core of something that really will bring the local community together. That is what their local-roots.co.uk organisation really wants to achieve. Its main aim is to encourage a love of community and a love for nature. Really fabulous project, and personally, I wish them all the best.